Good morning. It's great to see everybody on this sunny day. And I'd like to welcome new friends and friends that have been here all along. The beauty of clouds and water is we invite everybody into the circle. It's huge, and that's the beauty of a circle. Is no one is left out. So we wholeheartedly welcome you, including the beings that we don't see. They're here too. I want to begin by offering homage. Homage to the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and all our great mothers. Homage to the Dakota nations who cared for this land, in whose house we are guests. Homage to the ancestors and the unseen beings who support and strengthen all. Homage to our teachers, family, and friends. Thank you. As I was preparing for this talk, which is actually a continuation of our conversation from last week, I've got to acknowledge, I kept thinking, how can I express this talk in a way that's relevant to our current conditions? How do I speak about training the mind in concentration, insight, and wisdom in relation to the great suffering of all beings with the hurricane in Houston, with the fires in California, fires in Montana, the flooding in Bangladesh, Nepal, India. Mumbai's getting pounded too. And that's our challenge as practitioners of the way. How are we relevant? And how do we express that relevancy in the current conditions that are arising in this moment? And simultaneously, within that suffering, there's also birth. There's also babies being born, people graduating, all kinds of celebrations. How do we hold this? So, with that in the back of my mind, there's a saying that really spoke to me this week. And I'd like to begin with that and move forward. What you fear will not go away. It will take you into yourself and bless you and keep you. That's the world, and we all live there. I understand that William Stafford is attributed to saying this. I'd like to read it again. I don't know if it speaks to you, but it really spoke. It speaks to me and why I do what I do, and including my fear in my life and going through it. What you fear will not go away. It will take you into yourself and bless you and keep you. That's the world, and we all live there. Heavy sigh. I heard that. You let it out for all of us. Thank you, whoever that was. It was gentle and powerful. So last week, I spoke about a story about the Buddha. And I actually, I got the book from my friend, though it does not mean I have a clear mind, because she initially was keeping this book until after I got back from Tassajara, because she felt my mind was very active, which is true. But aren't all our minds active? It's good not to be alone. This book is called The King of Glorious Sutras, called The Exalted Sublime Golden Light, a Mahayana Sutra. And really, it's beautiful. It's got a beautiful, exalted title. And it's just a lot of stories about the Buddha. In the particular story that I want to again review with you, and for those who have already heard it, I apologize, and I will also offer new information so it's not completely known. In chapter 18, it's the chapter of the tigress. And it's a story that actually the Buddha tells his disciples. And the story is about this bodhisattva. This bodhisattva whose name, I want to make sure I get it correct, is Mahadeva. So Mahadeva was in the forest with his two brothers. And they were walking in the forest, deep in the forest, and they came upon this tigress down below. And it was apparent that she was starving. And she had five cubs. And when they came upon this tigress, the brothers were like, you know, this is very daunting. What should we do? Mahapranadaya said, "Oh, good fellows, giving one's body is a daunting task." And I thought to myself, yeah. Wow. That would be extremely daunting. Thank you for expressing our concern, Mahapranadaya. And then Mahasattva said, "For people like us, feeble-minded and greatly attached to the body, such an act is difficult indeed. However, great beings embark on giving their bodies completely and dauntlessly, strive for others' welfare. That's the Bodhisattva vow, right? Where what Mahasattva is expressing is that, yes, even though people like us, because of our attachment to ourselves, to our bodies, to our minds, to our things, it's very difficult to act in such what appears to be such an extreme manner. Well, I think it is an extreme manner of giving one's body to another being. Then he goes on to say, moreover, born of affectionate love and compassion, Arya beings who consider their bodies as just obtained in heaven or on this earth, their joyous minds most agreeably to saving others' lives, remaining steadfast, would have 100-fold compassion in this case. That's the Bodhisattva ideal, maybe, that those conditions of seeing the tigress starving would create such a sense of compassion that, of course, there would be no other response than to offer one's body to the tigress. Easier said than done. And that's what the Buddha did. That's what Mahasattva did. Is from this compassion, he jumped and offered himself to the tigress. And the story doesn't end there, because Mahasattva was loved. He was loved by his family. Although he was a human being, a bodhisattva, he was still a human being. And people loved him. His brothers loved him, his mother, his father. He was well loved. So even though he was a bodhisattva and he jumped, people grieved for him. They grieved the loss. And that's the human condition. That's our capacity to love each other and care about each other and our connection with each other. And then, because the Buddha is telling the story to his disciples, he says, I, the Tathagata, Shakyamuni, was formerly Mahasattva, son of King Maharatha, who made the tigress well. Sidona, the great king, was the king called Maharatha, and Queen Maya was the sublime queen. Mahapranada became Maitreya. Likewise, Prince Mahadeva was the youthful Manjusri. The tigress was Maha Prajapati. The five bhikkhus were her five cubs. So the king in this story, Mahasattva's father, was later the king of Siddhartha Gautama, who later became the Buddha. The queen Maya, what later became Siddhartha Gautama's mother. In Maha Prajapati, the tigress, was the later became Siddhartha's mother after his mother died shortly after his birth. The five bhikkhus. The five bhikkhus are the ones that were disciples of Siddhartha Gautama and eventually heard the Buddha's first sermon. So some people just see it as a story, a kind of a dramatic story. And I view it as the reincarnation and the training that the Buddha experienced lifetime after lifetime in order to make that decision, to have that compassion and love arise within him and expressed through his body, offering his body to the tigress. And how do we get there? How do we move forward beyond thinking that maybe this act is just extreme and made up? And maybe, how do we maintain meaning and not get caught up in nihilism, that having no self means everything is meaningless? How do we cultivate a mind that's rooted in altruism, the bodhisattva vow, and develop, embody this through training of the mind? Because we don't live in a monastery. We live in a world with children, jobs, maybe aging parents, families, suffering, day-to-day activities that occur. We don't live in some exotic jungle where we can go and hang out with lions and tigers and bears. And last week, one of the things that I talked about was training the mind through virtuous conduct, practicing the precepts, meditation, to develop concentration, and then wisdom. And developing the strength of mindfulness. Mindfulness is very, very important in developing concentration. To be able to quiet down the mind enough, even in activity. So being on the cushion provides us the ability to practice so that when we are in activity, we can have the opportunity and the possibility of seeing the mind going out. Seeing the mind going out and starting to say stories. Oh, I see that person. Oh, that person is pretty. Oh, that person, not so pretty. Seeing the stories that the self is creating and slowly blocking those stories and bringing the mind back to just seeing without the judgment, without the criticism, without the liking, just seeing. So reining the mind in. So when there's seeing, there's just seeing. When there's hearing, there's just hearing. When there's smelling, there's just smelling. So the senses, this is just information. And how do we respond to this information? Because this mind training is no small matter. This mind training is what the world might... I don't want to get intense here. I'm trying to keep it light. Thanks, Leonard. So it is, this mind training is no small matter to me or to the world right now. The world needs clarity. The world needs wisdom. And what does that look like? For each one of us, it will look different. Given our personalities, given our conditions, given to what our capacity is at the time, the resilience that we have at the time will depend upon how we respond. And it's very important. If we are to have a chance in helping in any way the suffering in this world, including our own suffering, we need to have a clear mind that comes from training the mind. And it's no small task. It's no small task, as many of you experienced today, to bring that mind back. Because the mind just goes. It enjoys the story. It relishes in the conditions that it's creating that is not even real. Because if you bring the mind to this present moment, it's much different than where the mind is taking you in your thoughts, feelings, and stories. So that's part of the reason, too, I want a full disclosure here. That's why I'm going to Tassajara. Because I'm committed to clarifying and purifying this mind at a deeper level. I've had experiences after experiences of seeing the mind as it is. And it goes away. That clarity goes away. I'm like, isn't there a cumulative effect here? No, there is no cumulative effect. It's just practice. And I don't mean to dissuade you. It's very important practice. Because there's also joy that goes with this practice. It's not all like... It's not all negative. There's two sides. There's the suffering which cannot be denied, though we try to. It's happening. And there's also the joy of the life that is happening simultaneously and intersecting continuously. And how do we hold them both? Equanimity. And what is this equanimity? This equanimity is not detachment. It is not cutting off the heart and saying, oh, I'm equanimous and I'm detached. That's not it. The equanimity, and I don't know, I'm not going to say that, sit up here, I'm not, and break the precept of, what is it, truth-telling? I don't want to lie to you. It's not easy, and I've not experienced it very much, if at all. I'm working towards it, holding life in its own terms, in a balanced way. So I talked about last week how the concentration has the capacity to suppress the hindrances. And I want to move forward into the five aggregates. The five aggregates are form, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness. And in our chant book, many of us have chanted the Heart of Great Perfect Wisdom Sutra, which is a beautiful sutra. And I just want to talk about the, I think the first four lines. Okay. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. Avalokiteshvara is a bodhisattva that has, I don't know, tens of thousands of arms and hands. And each hand has an eye and an instrument to help all beings. So if you look up Avalokiteshvara, in some of the pictures, you'll see just this fan of hands and eyes and tools. Because if there's 7 billion human beings on this planet, and each person has their own conditions, it's going to take a lot of different tools to serve all beings. That's just the humans. So there's the winged, there's the four-legged, there's the fin, there's the roots, on and on and on. There's a myriad of beings that that Avalokiteshvara is open to helping. So she needs a lot of tools and instruments. So, and Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, is the Bodhisattva of compassion. Okay, so in the Heart Sutra, her name is first, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. When deeply practicing Prajna Paramita, wisdom beyond wisdom, and that's what we're trying to cultivate through insight, moving to wisdom beyond wisdom. So Avalokiteshvara is deeply practicing this concentration and moving into this wisdom. Clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. So Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha's teaching is that we are comprised of five aggregates, all of us. Form, sensation, perception, formation, consciousness. So all these aggregates make us up. Avalokiteshvara, seeing that these aggregates were empty, was relieved of all suffering. So what did she see? She saw that each aggregate is impermanent, that it's changing, that it's arising and passing away, each beyond the human's ability of time. These moments are arising and changing. She saw that each aggregate creates suffering, that there's no security, there's no stability, and yet there's attachment, and in that attachment there is suffering. She also saw that each aggregate is comprised of a non-self. There's a sense of corelessness. When you try to look for yourself or a self, it's not there. So that's what she saw. And because she saw that these aggregates, she saw everything is empty. It's not a nothingness. It's an emptiness that has a fullness of all of life that's interconnected. This is the awakening of insight into the interconnectedness of all life, seen, unseen, the fullness and the possibilities within this interconnection. This is the transformation for us, the possibility. In Zen, we do not talk about the jhanas. Though the Buddha does talk about the jhanas. And the jhanas are what helps the mind to move from concentration, mindfulness, meditation, into an absorbed state, a state of absorption. So I just want to read to you what the Buddha says about the jhanas. Tireless energy was aroused in me. An unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled. My mind concentrated and unified. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. So the Buddha is sitting. His mind, he's able to apply, to place his mind, whether it's on the breath or emptiness, space, and he can sustain it. He can sustain his mind. And from that comes joy and pleasure born of seclusion. And some of you may have experienced this. It's real. With the stilling of applied and sustained thought, I entered upon and abided in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and single-mindedness of mind without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. So now applied and sustained thought have dropped away. There's just observing at this point. And in that observation is freedom, is joy, rapture, bliss, and pleasure, born of this ability, this concentration. With the fading away as well as rapture, I abided in equanimity, in mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body. I entered upon and abided in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce, he has a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and mindfulness. That's so beautiful. because rapture fades away. Rapture kind of excites the mind. It has a very kind of seductive quality because it's nice to be blissed out. It's nice to be in rapture and have that joy. Simultaneously, that's not really spiritual stability, that blissed outness. And if we stop there, that's not it. That bliss is not it. It's dropping that away, just like the Buddha says. It fades away, and he's abiding in equanimity. And he's mindful, and he's fully aware. He's very present. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, I entered upon and abided in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure in purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. So it all falls away at that point. And there's just thusness or suchness. I want to talk about, he says, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain. So when one is in jhana, I thought in jhana there would be no grief. There'd be no sadness. It would only be bliss. In jhana, there is sadness. There's both pleasant and unpleasant feelings. The jhana factors, which are laid out in the Abhidharma, which is also, it's a Theravadin text, but it does come from the suttas. The jhana factors include initial application, which we just heard, the ability to place the mind, sustained application, the ability to have the mind constant throughout, what's constantly anchored in the object that the mind is holding, zest, one-pointedness, pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, including sadness and grief, and equanimity. And this equanimity does not have pleasant or unpleasant feelings. This equanimity is neutral. It's neutral in the sense is that it's observing the conditions as they are in this moment. Keeping the mind intensely focused on the object, the mind is absorbed. The jhanas in the mind intensely focus the mind and concentrate the mind on the object. This, I believe, is a very important skill to develop. Though I don't know much about wisdom, I have had a little experience with concentration. And I feel that this ability to maintain samadhi, maintain the mind in a concentrated state in our lives, will support us being able to respond to white supremacy, to racism, two horrific conditions like the hurricanes and the fires that are happening, to genocide. Because whether we are ready or not, these conditions are happening. And I feel as a Buddhist, a Zen Buddhist priest, and a member of a Buddhist community, I have a responsibility. That my responsibility is not to sit on the cushion in a jhanic state, being intoxicated and blissed out, while the earth is on fire. However, that jhanic state will support refreshing my mind. So when I go out in the world, I can respond from a more equanimous state instead of being angry all the time and hateful. I mean, I'm not going to lie. Anger arises. Hate arises. And what is my response? That is the human condition. My response is to be authentic with those feelings, not create suffering for myself or other beings. Simultaneously, take care of them. Take care of my fear, because what I fear will not go away. And that's why I went to Auschwitz-Birkenau. That's why I went on the streets of San Francisco. That's why I went to the Black Hills. And that's why I'm going to Tassajara. Because fear arises, and it will be there. And I'm not going to let it paralyze me. I'm going to take it with me wherever I go. Fear. Oh, there you are again. Darn. Okay. Come with me. In fact, sit beside me. And let's figure this out together. Because that fear is energy. And that's energy that I need going forward. That's energy we need going forward. And what I'd like is I'd like to hear from you what your thoughts are and any questions or comments that you have. Because we are in this together. We are intimately connected. And trust me, I have tried to say I'm an independent human being. It's not true. And the more I open up to that and let that in and let go of myself, the more possibilities, because together we are amazing in our potentiality, amazing at what we can do. So thank you. Thank you for being here. And please, if you have any questions or comments, this is your time for conversation with me and with the Sangha. Angie?
I'm a little confused about that idea of a bodhisattva jumping into being eaten by a tiger.
Because of the precept? Or can you talk more?
I just feel like I've heard, feel like it kind of contradicts things. Other things I've heard about having empathy for yourself too, and taking, you know, mm-hmm. like that seems very extreme.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is an extreme practice, and it's not uncommon. There's a chud practice in Tibetan Buddhism where people offer themselves to beings that are suffering. There were examples at Standing Rock where people offered their bodies on the front lines on behalf of water, on behalf of us, and we didn't even know it. It's the breaking up of this concept of what is this me, mine, and I? What is really me, mine, and I? Simultaneously, I want to be respectful because we live in a relative world. We live in a world where people have families, they have kids. You cannot be jumping off the cliff when you have kids. I mean, that's, and this isn't about suicide. This isn't about nihilism. When Mahasattva made that decision to jump, that was a wholeheartedly based on training decision. It was no small matter. He had trained for this lifetime after lifetime. So wherever one is at, that's where you are at. And it's very important to respect where you are in time and space. I'm not advocating that everybody go jump off a cliff. What I am advocating is that wherever you are, and whatever that cliff looks like, because maybe it looks like feeding your kids Cheerios in the morning after you've been up all night with another sick kid. That's jumping off a cliff. I invite you, open up the mind. Break it up just a little bit. And maybe I'm speaking from direct experience of my mind being blown wide open. So I want to be respectful of the relative that we are currently living in and being in relationship with. Does that make sense?
So it's more like a metaphor for, I guess some people, you're right, are sacrificing their actual bodies.
Yes, they are. And that's the koan, right? Right there. How do you sacrifice your own body and yet you live in this, in the world that you live in with these conditions? What does that look like? It may not look like feeding yourself to a tigress. Tom, Tyken?
One thing that comes up for me, there was a guy named Bob Kelly, no longer alive. He was a priest at Ryumunji. He was a disciple of Shokan. He had been a military veteran in the United States, and he was in Saigon and witnessed the first self-immolation by a Buddhist monk, which was a form of protest against the brutality of the war. So I don't think that he had any idea what gift he was getting from this guy. But over time, he became, and I don't know, I really didn't know him. I just know about him. I think I know about him anyway. But you can see that those kinds of self-sacrifice activities actually have an impact
yes.
on many, many other people.
Yes.
And that's all I wanted to do.
Thank you. Thank you.
And also, when you sit in meditation and you're in deep, doesn't that peace that you're creating, or the peace, the equanimity that you're intending, it goes forth from you? And so I think that when we sit in meditation, the rest of the beings do benefit.
Yeah.
So I think, I can make a case for just sitting in meditation as being active.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, just as simple as everyday courage in life. I mean, talking about the fires, and you've got the firefighters that are willing to risk their life to save others, the people in the boats in Texas willing to risk their life for, I think it's just something that goes on every day and we sometimes don't see it. You know.
Thank you. Yes. Tenryu.
I also see that story about the tiger is how hard it is to let go of our ego, mm-hmm. my ego. my sacrifice. It's mm-hmm. not giving my body to the tiger, but it might be accepting my spouse's perspective, just being with it instead of fighting.
Mm-hmm.
That might be the work of a year.
Mm-hmm.
Or so that's the problem, just how hard. And so to say that kind of sacrifice or difficulty, at first I was like, what the heck? But not that long.
During Tenshin Roshi's retreat, he spoke of, he used this metaphor from this carnival ride that used to be at an amusement park nearby here, I guess, where there was this ride where it went around in circles,
mm-hmm.
and many people were on the outside of the circle whirling around, and he was very attracted to being in the center.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and spoke to him about watching my daughter make what I consider difficult, not necessarily the most wholesome choices. And I spoke to him about feeling like I was a bystander watching from, you know, the outside and watching and feeling fearful.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, you're right in the center with her.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be right in the center.
Mm-hmm.
And whether, not necessarily advocating being a helicopter parent, because that's not what he was saying, but being with somebody in great difficulty right by their side and supporting them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when you're doing that, there's no room to get stuck in the fear. You have to just be there. And I'm very grateful for his teachings
mm-hmm.
about that.
Mm-hmm.
And one other thing is my teacher Dokai was talking to me about intimacy being not personal. And so when I hear about Mahasattva, is that who
jumped? Mm-hmm.
Just jumping and offering its body to the tiger, that seems to me like the ultimate intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just letting go of our own stories and just being right there.
Mm-hmm.
Just
no gap.
No gap. Just completely intimate.
Thank you. I think we just got word from our Eno.
Please join in the closing.